Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing to you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. This time we visit Martin Friedel, a composer. Martin was born in Germany and migrated to Australia as a child. He studied physics and mathematics and holds a PhD degree in chemistry from Melbourne University. He studied piano and conducting, and since the 1970s he has composed extensively for opera, for chamber ensembles, and has supported a freelance existence through composition for theatre, film and television. And for the latter he won an Emmy Award in 1999. I visited Martin in his study overlooking Sydney Road in Brunswick, Melbourne, and began by asking him how intellectual life started for him.
We lived with an uncle of mine, also in the village, who had, a holiday house, and he decamped, and he was the professor of classical archaeology at Munich University, and a scholar, so the book was... The house was encased in books, I suppose, and there was always, from earliest I can remember, that I had to be quiet because Uncle Ernst was working on his translations of the Greek tragedies. My mother was also a musician, and so what people did there, what you did on a Saturday and a Sunday, was to play chamber music with an assortment of musicians, some professional, some amateur. So I used to sit amongst them and listen to the classical repertoire, I suppose, starting with Haydn and finishing with probably Brahms. And that was just in the background, as it were. So I've always had books and music around me.
Did you like the music?
Oh, yes. I mean, I used to sit next to the cellist, who was also the local doctor, who was quite a fine amateur cellist. And the cello was the nicest instrument because you could sit next to it and have your ear close to it, and it would sort of hum and groan as he played. Yes, I really liked the music, but it was my mother practiced a lot, and I used to just sit under the piano while she practiced playing with whatever I had to play with. And that was... if I think of one impression of a childhood, that's the sort of impression that I have. He was quite an extraordinary man. He was a keen collector of riddles and jokes. So he was full of jokes. He's published books on riddles, Greek riddles. The Greeks apparently loved to riddle. So he was always full of riddles, I remember. And he also loved circuses. He was, in fact, a great authority on circuses. And as soon as the circus came to Munich, which was still bombed out, he took me and my brother along to this circus to the town. And I don't remember anything specific, but I do remember that there were certain books that we were allowed to look at if we were very careful, which were the children's books and the stories books, and others that we were forbidden to touch, of course. So there were lots of books around. One could pick at books and look at pictures, and I think that the feeling of having a book in the hand was one that sort of stuck, really.
Any art, any painting?
Yes, there were quite a few bits. There were some painters in the family. One of my grandmother's cousins was one of the painters who was expelled from Germany under the decadent art movement, and they went to Switzerland. My grandfather, once I was a keen amateur painter who hung around in Munich with most of the sort of bohemia at that time.
You were an official decadent.
Well, yes. So there were paintings, and there were painters in the family of various kinds. So there were pictures to look at.
Poetry.
Yes, a lot of books. I read a lot of the classic German children's books, I suppose, which are really the Grimm's fairy tales, obviously, which I still have a copy of. I still got most of my German children's books, 1001 Nights, and then Tales of Exotic Travel, I suppose, were the other favourites. We took all our books. I mean, I found my parents' travel documents and realised that because we come by ship, they come with a ton of equipment, which these days would be unthinkable of, except by container, I suppose. But Father brought his woodworking tools because he'd retrained as a cabinet maker after the war. And books and music, basically, and a few clothes. But mainly books, music, and my father's tools were the staple. There was no furniture that came with us. And little paintings and stuff like that that we had. And once we were there, I think we... like most migrant families, there's a good deal of sort of inwardness and a very sort of tight family unit that we all had to collectively stick together and work and do that sort of thing. But we had books, and my parents, I learned to read English, but I read all the German classics because my parents had them, all the Goethe, Schiller and so on. I was always a bit of a reader anyway by then. Yes, my father was very interested in science, and if he hadn't become an army officer, he would have said he would have wanted to study biology. That was his second sort of career choice. So he was interested in science as a sort of an amateur, I suppose, and enthusiastic that the boys do science. And this was the 50s when science was considered, in science, engineering and medicine were considered the only alternative for lads. And I bought my first microscope, which is up on the shelf there, from the through mail order catalogue and the Weekly Times for 5 shillings. And that was my first sort of... I bought that when I was 7, I think, with pocket money.
I think I had one very similar.
Well, that's that tiny little one up there, in fact. That's the one that's my first microscope. And I became interested in building machines, I suppose, that didn't run properly. And then as I went through school and learned more science, I built... I had a sort of little laboratory in my father's shed where I made, attempted to make explosives and also attempted to build high voltage generators there for a period of time. But that was interesting. But at high school I had a very good science teacher, and I think a man by the name of Arthur Mitchell, who came from Scotch College and moved to the country, I think for rural family reasons. And he was a very inspiring teacher, and he was an archetype of that 19th century science teacher who not only taught science, but he was interested in, he taught chemistry and physics, but he was interested in biology. He was a great collector. He collected rocks. He had a very fine collection of geological specimens from around that area within a short space of time. He went out and
Cathedral Ranges
and over to Mansfield, the quartz, there's a quartz mine there, a fantastic collection of quartz crystals. He collected and pressed plants, he collected insects, and so he was a sort of a, that sort of collector scientist, which is a sort of a 19th century phenomenon, I think. Mm-hmm. And he was very inspiring as a teacher. And just, I've always found science, some of the things, and certainly the some of the maths, to be aesthetically really pleasing. I mean, you can't but look at a quartz crystal and say that it's just a marvellous thing, or put an insect under the microscope and just be just amazed at what is revealed. And science sort of reveals sort of other worlds, the worlds of inanimate and animate objects, I think. And maths, I suppose, is that sort of ability to perform what are really quite amazing sort of feats of the mind. I mean, I think even Pythagoras' theorem is a marvel still, in the theorems of Euclid, that one can actually prove and order things according to ways that really aren't suggested by nature. Oh, the Cold War was a huge... I mean, I read... and there's a funny story here, because there's Neville Shute's book, On the Beach, which I read, and in fact, it was filmed, and part of it was filmed up at Narbathong in Marysville. We got a chance to see Ava Gardner in a less sober moments. But I read the book and was, of course, terrified. The end of the world, and because it was so close, it was happening
had
just in
Melbourne.
Had a
big impact on us.
Had a big impact. And it was, a lot of it was being filmed, and the local Boy Scouts were, in fact, filmed there, filming up the river, walking up the Akron River, singing Waltzing Matilda. And I remember being excluded from that because I wasn't a scout and didn't have a scout uniform. I really felt cheated. But it had a huge impact, because it felt very real that if you're making a film about it, it was one of those things that could happen. And so that sort of shadow of a bomb, I remember being, by the time I was, I suppose, 11 or 12, being there and being something that was seen quite real and quite a threat against one's future. And I suppose out of that later on at university came some sort of attempt to define, to find reasons, and the reasons why, I suppose, political and social, and that drew me into sort of politics on the fringes. But there's also an ethical thing, because by that time I got a book, a friend of ours gave me book orders, and I bought, I think at 12 or 13, I bought Einstein's, there's a series, collection of essays where he reflects on the bomb, and I was fascinated by these various arguments.
Physics and the bomb and politics all sort of tended to run together.
That's right. It's interesting to me to know, to reflect on how influenced I was by their argument, and whether people like Einstein and Russell, and I thought this at the time, would ever have any idea that somebody so far away and, you know, could actually be influenced by what they write. But I think it was true. There was another aspect of physics, of course, and that was that it was slightly dangerous and quite sort of sexy. I mean, I remember seeing the Scientific American in the school library, and at the back there was usually an advertisement for Oak Ridge Laboratories, and it would show Oak Ridge sort of low-slung laboratories surrounded by leafy woods, and in the foreground would be a scientist in a Cadillac or Pontiac with a blonde next to him, and this was a good life. This is
The RAND Corporation used to advertise in Scientific America.
That's right. This was where you had the good time, you could earn the big money, and thinking about megadeths, or perhaps, there was, of course, that other great romantic figure of that part of science, and that was Oppenheimer, who played with the devil as a very sort of Faustian figure of the time. And I remember reading Brighter Than a Thousand Suns, which is the story of the development of the bomb, and being fascinated by sort of Oppenheimer's fascination with fame and danger and money and sex and it. So it was a fairly diabolical brew, really. Well, I think a lot of the scientists of that time, and Einstein, Einstein was a musician scientist as well, there was a lot of... and this was what made it very seductive. These people, men mostly, although a few women, were not simply very good at what they did. They were quite extraordinary in their grasp and in their depths and breadths of their interest in a whole range of things. And if they'd been simply technocrats or just simply focused on the one thing, they would have been less interesting. But they were able to write well. They had not only interest in the world of literature and music, but they had wide connections within the world of literature and music and painting. So that made them as a sort of a role model, they were extremely attractive. When we arrived in Australia, we didn't have a piano, and my mother couldn't afford a piano until I was about 13 or 14. And then I could read music by that time. We had recorders, and mother taught me to read music, so I could read music and follow scores. And so I was a fairly late starter playing the piano, and she taught me, and that didn't really work out, because there'd be the inevitable sort of blending of domestic mother-son arguments and piano practice arguments. And we lived in a very small house, so practice had to be done on a regimented system, because my father didn't like to hear the piano going all the time. but it continued, and I sort of learned from her and I taught myself. And school music, I must say, left me cold, and I really hated most of school. I kept well away from music at school, which made science far more interesting again, of course. But I followed it, and in terms of listening to music and reading music and playing what I could. So I was a mixture of self-taught, taught by mother, until I was in third year at university, and then I went to the conservatorium and auditioned for a teacher and took piano lessons there for about 5 years. Look, I've always simply accepted that as part of my life in one form or another. once you start writing music and actually trying to create it, your attitude towards listening changes quite a lot. You listen far more selectively, you listen in a different way. I amassed in that period of before I turned to composing, of just listening and looking to music. And as a student, I didn't have much money. I went to as many free things as I could, but I listened to whatever I could. I knew the sort of 17th, 18th, 19th century standard classical music repertoire quite well, and parts of the piano repertoire I knew extremely well. 20th century music, I only came in contact with at university slowly and with some resistance, but that's of course where I've gravitated to. So I met Stockhausen when he came here, and there would have been in 1970 or 71 possibly, and of course it wasn't just a sort of contemporary music scene that was there, but a lot from a popular music scene who interested in what sort of gear the man was using. When I started doing piano exams, I then had to start doing some theory exams as well in order to progress. And so I did theory, and I found that remarkably easy. I mean, it wasn't difficult, but quite enjoyable too. And I took a few lessons in harmony and counterpoint, but then decided I could do better by myself because the standard of teaching was quite poor. And by this time I was doing postgraduate physics, And the sort of level of problems that I was thought arrogantly that I should be solving were of a far higher order than simple harmony and counterpoint. So I decided to teach myself, which I did. And that process gradually started to osmose into writing pieces, because there's a point where exercises become little works within themselves if they're to have any meaning. And that just continued, and really didn't until I came into contact with what might be that sort of first stream of the new theatre wave, and through my wife. The transition came, I suppose, from just doing these exercises for myself and doing them by the way, to actually being involved in a production, a little theatre production, somebody asking me to write and arrange music, and then to perform it. And that's when it became serious, I suppose, that somebody actually outside wanted this, that there was a purpose for these pieces. And then I tried to write some, I think the first piece I did was a piece by Chris Hemmingsley, it's like a very experimental piece. He was a poet, but this was theatre pieces. The theatre was a greater influence initially. I think I was a fairly introspective child, and I probably still tend to be introspective, and then introspection leads to a certain degree of isolation and being by oneself, which is, you know, both good and...
Well, a creative life can be something of a refuge as well as...
Well, it is, I think it's... I mean, I think of music as my consolation, and that's always something that I can turn to when the world gets unpleasant or cruel or mean. And I think that one of the functions of art is to console. I don't quite know what that means beyond what it means for me personally. But I remember my father saying that, you know, he worked on a timber mill for 10 or 15 years, which is hard, noisy work. And I once as a child asked him, what did you think about while he trudged up and down behind the saw bench with his 300 horsepower diesel motor, you know, a few metres away, and the appalling noise and dust. And he said, well, he thinks of all the art books at night. He would go home and before he went to bed look at some art books of the art that he liked, and then during the day he'd think about those pictures. He wasn't a musical man, but that was the way, his way of sort of keeping his equilibrium. And I think that's one of the functions of art and literature, is in fact to make life bearable, both for its creators and for its consumers. So I've never really lost that confidence. There are times when my desire to actually write music waxes and wanes like everything else. Sometimes It goes into hibernation for a few weeks or a few months, and then other times it's a sort of, it's slightly obsessive compulsive, really. Cantata is comes from the word to sing, and it loosely it's a sort of a dramatic. It's like an opera without sets, without scenery, without costume, without movement, without acting. But there are within a cantata there is a dramatic structure which is quite similar to that of the opera. And since I've always been interested in the use of text and music, words and music, right through theatre, the cantata is a nice form because it obviates some of the problems with opera, the main being the difficulty of staging it, the fact that opera is often very poorly staged, that it's a very difficult form to wrestle with. So the cantata is a stripped-down version of that, which allows basically for the expression of ideas. Music normally isn't very good for ideas, but the cantata and the opera do allow, as well as the song, of course. Song's still a further pared-down version. An opera with Madame Butterfly, who was based on an actual historical Japanese figure whose house was not far from the epicentre of the bomb that hit Nagasaki. So there are a lot of interesting things to reflect on. And reading the material then, things that were actually said, the conversations, the recollections of conversations, it struck me that of people like Einstein and Bohr and others, that they were in fact often, as they were remembered or written down, condensed, fragmented and quite poetic in some of their statements. What the Curies said about radium, which they first observed, was quite poetic, the descriptions that they gave it. And I then really took what was said and basically pared it down a bit more, but and used these conversations and tried to show that how a few conversations led to a certain path, I suppose. There was a bit about Oppenheimer and there's a bit Einstein and so on, but most of them were based on conversations and conversations. Before the silence in fact was the last thing, and that was the how a Japanese girl who was thrown into the air through the explosion remembered hearing a loud noise and nothing at all because their eardrums had been broken, and so there was this complete silence. It struck me that science, apart from science fiction literature, has been terribly neglected. But it was, and I think to some extent there's an interest in it now. But it's one of the great strands of human endeavour that ranks along with religion, I think, as a sort of major sort of thrust. And it always struck me it's been neglected because it's had this sort of... whereas religion's been dealt with time and time again in all sorts of ways. The third planet covered the notion of flight, and for me, what is the enigma of why we want to fly and the line that leads to space exploration. And I think that these are always... that the ideas of science have taken their root in some ancient Jungian collective dreams, that the need to fly, I mean, you read it in Ovid, in the Metamorphoses about Icarus. These dreams of flying go back a long way, and it's always struck me as being curious why we want to fly, what part this forms of our consciousness, why space exploration. And so this was on, the third planet was on that theme, and it took... it traced the sort of story back to Ovid and Galileo, and then I found a lovely book of the sort of words of the astronauts and cosmonauts, who, of course, were all chosen for their psychological stability and their ability to think and act rationally under all possible circumstances. And yet, as soon as they're confronted with a picture of the Earth underneath and with a vision of the Earth underneath them out there in the darkness of space, their words, the things that they think in fact are, become poetic, they become religious, they become metaphysical, even in sort of clumsy ways. And somehow the power of what they're experiencing washes away that sort of the trappings of rationalism in some way. And so the experience becomes a sort of a life-changing one. I was interested in that, and so I used fragments from these thoughts and conversations. And the final one, the cities of the mind, was really about the other sort of strand, which is the ability, the desire to somehow, human desire to replicate oneself as a machine, whereby the machine becomes a servant and is able to do or think, amplify our thoughts or our actions to a great extent. In other words, a search for power. And it goes back once again to myth and legends, to the golem, to Rabbi Lerner's Golem of Prague. Mm-hmm. The idea of creating a homunculus, it goes into 19th century literature with Frankenstein, of course. And it's here now, it's with us well and truly, with the fascination of robots. Robotics, yeah. People who and the computer, so the age of the computer, cybernetics, and I suppose on the other hand the convergence of that with psychiatry, psychology, neuropsychology, man as a thinking machine.
Terror Inferno, I think that was on flight too.
That's right. It was an option.
Was the one on the rooftop.
That's
of the
right.
City.
Yep.
The performance was on a rooftop in the city some years ago. On a brilliantly clear night, as I remember.
Yes.
It was spectacular. So that was the third planet in the opera version.
Well, it was with some other thoughts that I came across. There's a long prologue about gravity and heaviness. And I mean, I think our desire for flight has something to do with the tugging back of gravity that we feel that we have to counter at every move. So it was to do with the notion, with Terra Inferma was a sort of a more poetic look at, I suppose, at wanting to escape. And I took it to a skyscraper rooftop because I thought that would be a reveal those things that in such a way that you wouldn't have to talk about them, really.
It should be performed now with all the Mars controversy.
Well, yes, I'm fascinated by all this space exploration and by the notion of... Because who we are, what we're doing here has got some connection with what is out there, but I don't think that connection is a simple one, nor has it been plumbed, and our attempts to do so are in a mechanical way.
Are there any other works?
There's another one called Foxy, which hasn't been performed here, which is in fact about Klaus Fuchs. Fuchs is a German for fox, and it's about Fuchs and Oppenheimer, basically, right. About the two different sorts of betrayal that happened. That Fuchs was the person who basically sold the secrets to Stalin, and of course Oppenheimer sold himself, in some eyes, to the military-industrial complex of America. In fact, gave them a great kick on. But once one starts to look at all of these and look at people in detail, of course, it's not as simple as that. If we look back two or three into times that we can't experience except through the artifacts that they leave behind. And the artifacts, I mean, in writing, the paintings, music, if it's there, those are the things that actually help us form our judgment as to what sort of a civilization it was and give us some understanding. It's what is left behind. It's the best of what is left behind is often the art, and it's often the most human thing that's left behind, and it's often the most. Music, for example, is a very has left a very complete record from, say, the 12th or 13th century when notation Western music began. It's possible to, in fact, understand that the musical sophistication and imagination and attempt to engage with an audience and with the world around them was of an amazing sophistication 600-700 years ago, and there's no reason to believe why it wasn't so even earlier on. And in fact, they found musical instruments that date back and right up to 50,000 years ago, so that music's one of the earliest expressions, art impulses, I would say, that where its origins are, I don't know, but it obviously lies very close to that, possibly the development of consciousness. I think art and consciousness are very closely intertwined, but I don't quite know how. Music came into the church a long, long time ago, into religion, and it has a legitimate part, and whatever you call religion may not just be the worship of God, but may in fact be some sort of faith in who we are and why we're doing things. I think that the Christian God is just one. I mean, you look at Eastern music, Balinese music, it has a lot of that has a religious function, but the religious focus of it is different to ours. They don't actually sing and praise God, but the music has a religious connection nonetheless. I think Western music, the secular music, has a lot of things going for it, and a lot of things that it talks about, and most composers anyway have some sort of political views, and most of them are based on some sort of information. Some of this creeps into the work as a matter of interest, and if it does, I think it's fine. I think that the sort of agitprop music has its place, but it's a short-lived, it's functional music. It's like the music of military bands, it's to get two people to march in a certain direction. There are two aspects here. One is the actual, what you might call the ideological issue. The second is the musical issue. If the Greek Orthodox Church, which is heavily based on Gregorian chant, plain song, and a whole lot of other things, they're obviously things that Taverner likes and likes to use. And it's a part of what I'd call a sort of a flight in music from modernity. It's a backward flight. And a lot of those elements are there in the it's a reaction against the serialisation of music, the modernist music prior to the Second World War, Schoenberg, Berg, people like all the serialists, basically, and people like Schnittke, who is a sort of, Schnittke is actually a combination, his music's quite complex, but Taverner and others have gone back to try and find the simple aspects of music in terms of harmony and in terms of rhythm. And they've turned their back on it. I think the minimalist movement, which was Steve Reich and Philip Glass and John Adams, the American, was an attempt to turn back the music away from dissonance, away from its appeal to a small audience, to try and appeal to a larger audience again. And the religious aspect of music, because religious music is understood by almost everybody that belongs to a society, is an obvious sort of area to go into, I think. Of the class struggle or of the currency exchange or of anything else. Music by itself doesn't do anything like that. The only argument I suppose I have against people like Taverner or others is that their function sometimes has become, with the CD and with people playing them a lot, a bit like musical wallpaper, that they're an attempt to shut out the world, which is unpleasant and so on, by putting on some pleasant music. It's easy to listen to music. And I think of necessity some are, the listening of music, the looking at pictures and the reading of literature should involve some effort. And I think some of the music that is coming out, and some of it's good. I mean, I like Arvo Pärt, for example, the Estonian composer. But nonetheless, it requires, on some ways it's more suited to the CD and it requires less effort. Taverner, while he's interested in the music of the Greek Orthodox, I mean, 200 or 300 years ago, people didn't listen to music all the time. They didn't have music to work to unless they had somebody playing or singing in the house. 400 years ago, when you went to bed, it was usually when the candle ran out, and there was no sound on the street except the occasional drunk or the ox cart or whatever, or animals. Houses in northern Germany, for example, were shut up in the winter and must have smelt and been horrible places. So that to go to the church where it smelled of incense, where the air was fresh, where it was warm because they were heated, and where there was music and candlelight, was a wonderful and very powerful experience. And that's changed. And so it's, if one reads, I've just been reading a book by Bach, and one thinks of Bach playing to small audiences in his time. It's not true. I mean, some of the cathedrals where he worked held 2,000 or 3,000 or 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. So he played to audiences of 5,000 people. But these people only went to music once a week as part of the church. The church used music as a sort of a lever, just like it used the incense to make things palatable. So I think you've got to somehow separate out the musical forms from the function. For me, a piece of late Mahler, a piece of Schoenberg, a piece of Bartok can be just as elevating in some ways as a Gregorian chant, which is based on a much sort of simpler technique. Just like if I look at a Picasso, I can find it as interesting as a woodcut from the Middle Ages. I think that style and intent are the two things that have got to be kept separate. But one mustn't forget that there's an interesting essay by Walter Benjamin about music or art in the age of its mechanical reproducibility, where he questions the fact that does the value of the work change when it's on repetition, when it's repeated in a mass way. And I think a simple way of that is to look at, say, Van Gogh or Gauguin or whatever, the prints that one sees on every dentist's walls. The works themselves, I think, lose power by that. I, for example, really, there are certain works by Beethoven and Mozart that get played so often that I don't need to listen to them anymore. And I'm a bit different because most composers don't listen to it. I go on listening binges. And I really only listen to things now that I haven't heard before, because there's so much there that... I mean, I know the Schubert, the Brahms, the Schumann, the Tchaikovsky, the Rimsky-Korsakov, the Mahler, the Wagner. I don't need to listen to them except to learn something new. And so my view is different. The music of... I suppose a lot of what's happened in music is to do with the CD and the fact that music was one of the things that lent itself to the electronic reproducibility. And so it's possible now to hear music without any effort. I remember an essay by Debussy on this. He questioned the value of listening to music or taking in art without making any effort. To look at... pictures of Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci, just have to buy a book. 200 or 300 years ago, you had to make the pilgrimage to Italy to see them. And look at the effect on other artists that pilgrimage to Italy had, on German, on North European artists, being have to go over the Alps. I mean, it became a life-changing thing. Going to the bookshop and picking up a set of prints is no longer a life-changing experience. 100 years ago, look at the piano that's here. It's built in 1902. In 1902, the piano factory that made that in Germany probably made 50,000 pianos a year to go into homes. Every home would have had a piano. Most families would have had one or two members that played the piano. That's gone. And in its place, something else has happened, and it's got a different role and function. And I think we listen to music as a sort of a background to the film of our lives, in a way. It's become very similar to a soundtrack. I mean, my situation is different because I live in sort of silence most of the time. I prefer silence. The great paradigm is, of course, it's Germany. We are looking through my father's library. It was a well-judged library. There were works of Greek philosophers, humanist writers, a whole lot of stuff there, which would... And they were printed in Germany in the 1930s in huge editions of 500,000. Is not unusual for a successful writer like Thomas Mann or so on. In fact, the writers made a very good living. But it didn't stop anything from happening. When it came, push came to shove, the Germans voted for Hitler and most played along. And so all this musical sophistication, all this culture, all this love of the arts was a fairly narrow, thin little shell of protection. The Germans should have had more. If art has a moral quality of uplifting and spirit, then the Germans should have been uplifted as much or more than anybody else at that time. Mm-hmm. And yet they fell deeper than one would have ever thought it was possible.
How do you feel about it all? And looking forward to the rest of your life.
Well, I'm a late starter, so I think as far as music goes, I've only scratched the surface. I'm just beginning, and I think my achievements, you know, are very small indeed on any scale, and I'm looking forward. I think of new things to do. So I tend to look forward most of the time towards the next day's work, the next project. I don't see any sort of impetus for me coming from backward reflection, except reflecting on things and trying to work out. We all carry a sort of a little logbook inside us, which, you know, where we've been and what we've done and how much time we've spent and how fast we've moved. And sometimes you sort of check your own ship's log a little bit, you know, to see that you haven't gone round in a large circle. And embarked on some exercise in sort of futility, which is a product of your own psychology and its inadequacy to sort of assess the environment. But beyond that, for me, music isn't a career where there's an upward or downward movement. It's an occupation. It's a thing that I do. It's how I spend my time. And it's a thing that gives me pleasure, and it's the hardest thing I know at the same time, and it's a thing that continually engrosses me, that nags at me if I haven't done any for a week. And so I'll do it. I mean, I've got boxes of stuff, of unfinished, of sketches, of things. I always feel that the next thing I want to solve, this particular problem, which I really didn't come to grips with in the last one, or I'll attempt to do this. I always have, with each work I have, there's also, and no one knows this apart from myself, there's a tangible problem, technical problem that I have to try and have to solve. It's like giving yourself a mathematical problem to deal with, because it keeps me focused. And I learned this from the theatre. I learned about writing for different instruments in the theatre. And this was one of my great weaknesses, how to write for the tenor trombone, how to write for the bass clarinet, how to write for this. And I wrote for theatre, for professional theatre companies, and I got money to record and to hire musicians. So every new job I had, I tried to include instruments that I'd never written before, that I'd never come across. And so I would write for these, I'd ring up the players and say, what can you do? Can you do a trill between E-flat and F in this particular register? And they'd say yes or no, or how do you do double stopping on this? And so I'd learn about the instrument by writing for it, by giving myself a technical problem. And so I do that as well. There's that aspect to it, which is...
It sounds like there's a strong element of meditation in all that.
Yes, it is. When I do... My best work is done when I've either gone for a long walk in the morning, or I go for my swim or whatever, and most of my musical thoughts, the intense ones, happen within a 20-minute period of that. And then the rest of the day is trying to realise them and trying to make sense of them. But that's usually the impetus. If my day is right, starts with some sort of a musical thing. And I work on that then. And so there is an element for me, music, if it's appreciated and understood and I manage to make a living from it, that's terrific. But for me, it's an activity I do anyway, irrespective of any of those things. It's just after, you know, if I start from childhood, you know, listening to playing, thinking about music, it's been an activity that I can't do without, really. And so it's my occupation. Oh, I really love the Australian bush, because I grew up in it. I mean, I came from, when we landed in Australia, we landed first in Mondalbert in one room, and Preston in two rooms. And when we moved up to Narbathon, on the dividing range, it was like bliss for me, having all this bush.
So you feel you've struck some roots there. So you don't find yourself wishing you were living back in Germany or something?
No, it's the one thing. I mean, I feel in the cities, whenever I've been to Europe, to those parts of, you know, Europe that I know or aware of and I speak the language, I feel I blend in, I disappear. I feel perhaps a little bit of strange. What I've missed, and I know this from spending a winter in Berlin, I've become intensely homesick for the Australian bush. Not so much for the cities, because cities are much the same. You can find the sort of things here that you can find in Berlin or in London, or you can find them better in London. It's not even the architecture, but it's the Australian bush, I think, is especially, for some reason, in summer. is something that has a sort of a resonance for me that nothing else
and
has.
And a particular bush
forest that you've grown up in. I really love it all. I mean, I remember travelling, hitchhiking through central Australia and through northern Queensland, through the deserts and sleeping in the deserts at night. By the side of the road and being absolutely astonished by everything almost.
Yeah, but there's lyrebirds around though.
The lyrebirds, yeah. I mean, the bird life and the sort of small marsupial life and the big trees. I do like big trees. Big trees, there's a German thing about trees and forests, of course. Yeah. And I suppose that great divide with its, 70 and 80 metre mountain ashes is the epitome of a forest. It's a forest to outforest all other forests. And it's a pity that it's never been recognised, the importance of it.
You've got a pretty good study set up here.
Yeah, it's the first room where I've had a few books, a work desk, a table and my piano, or a piano at the same time. So that combination is... what I've always looked for. It's also the biggest room I've had to work in, so...
Yeah, it looks pretty cosy. Study with his father's collection of books, sitting at his piano, contemplating his little microscope that he'd bought as a child. I have a writing desk that sits in a window looking out onto the quiet corner of the front garden where I can see plenty of green and not much happening apart from an occasional bird passing through the foliage. To the left of my desk in the far corner of the study, I guess this is really the heart of it for me, I have two stacks of bookshelves floor to ceiling butting each other into the corner. And on those, of course, are plenty of books, but also my collections of objects and curios, my little museum with various bones, stones and shells, at the middle level on the other set of shelves. At eye level are the best books, the favourite books, easily accessible, easily contemplated. Here also on these shelves, a couple of my favourite curios. There's an old whale's tooth here, which was sent by a cousin of my mother's in South Africa, in Durban, many, many years ago, in a parcel of stuff sent to my mother. I wound up with that particular object. Then I have also something else I bought some years ago, possibly been my favourite object in recent years, which is a nautilus shell. It has a beautiful pearly luster on the inside, and I'm fond of contemplating this over a glass of red when I'm thinking about things. That's a brief account of that. On the other side of the desk, in the other corner, is what I've come to call the project table. My desk I like to keep clear, pretty clear most of the time, of all except current work. So a lot of stuff gets shunted off onto the project table where it sits waiting for something as I slowly accumulate material towards a certain project. And I may also use this table for displays of various kinds so that I can put objects out, pictures and other objects into an arrangement which helps me to contemplate the particular project. Just as an example, well, here's one, the Out of Africa debate. Now, this is something that has been an ongoing interest of mine for some years now. The orthodoxy that's current these days is that modern human beings came out of Africa somewhere south of the Sahara around 100,000 years ago. This is heavily based on DNA research, and that those people then spread fairly rapidly across the old world, including all the way down into Australia, replacing all the other populations of hominids on the way. The alternative model is the multi-regional model, whereby it's asserted that modern humans evolved in several places throughout Africa, Europe and Asia, and probably even Australia, possibly even Australia. I'm inclined to think something important happened in the Wallachia area. And of course, since I thought that, there were the spectacular finds on the island of Flores, announced in October 2004 by Mike Morwood and his co-workers. We'll be keeping that file open. Music in this program included extracts from Martin Friedel's string quartet called Night Pieces on a private recording, and two works kindly supplied by Move Records here in Melbourne. Our main theme from Bach's Prelude and Fugue in C, played by Ronald Farren Price, and In My Study, a movement from Handel Suite No. 5, played by Elizabeth Anderson. Check the study website for links to Move Records. And so, until next time, it's shut the door and reading lamp only in the study.